Roadrunners International Reunion, October 7, 2009, Pratt and Whitney J58, JT11D Engineers, Session 2, Johnny Dorotic and John Evans, conducted by Mary Pilevsky, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and NTS Oral History Project, recorded in collaboration with and at the Atomic Test Museum, Las Vegas, Nevada.
Recording, and we'll start with John. You'll tell me how you pronounce
Johnny.
Johnny, how you pronounce your last name?
Last name Dorotic.
Okay.
And my end of things was I came to Pratt Whitney in June of 1962, fresh out of college, and I was one of dozens of engineers who were hired into the J-58 program. My specialty became, quickly, I was interviewed on campus at Texas A&M and flown to Florida for an on-site interview, and this interviewing supervisors were in the performance analysis group, and that's where I got drafted into. I had several other areas that I had interest in, like metallurgy and so forth, but I never had that opportunity. I went right into the performance group, and I found a home relatively quickly. So engine performance and the giant leap from the manual U-tubes, the pressure gauges, and strip chart days of manual data to the computer age was really, I hit it right at the sweet spot.
Well, we'll talk more about that after introductions, because that's a very interesting aspect of the history. And now, John Evans.
My name's John C. Evans, and I came out of the Air Force. I was a crew chief on a B-47 medium jet bomber in Strategic Air Command. I came in as a jet assembler on the assembly floor. And basically what I did was I assembled, disassembled, clean hardware and stuff like that on the assembly floor, and also went down to the test cells, sea level and altitude, and did support on the engines down there. And so it, and I worked there from the August of 1958 to November of 1968.
Oh, wow.
So I was there 10 years. I got a little fancy Pratt Whitney 10-year bin with a dime in it.
Well, that's great. But so you were there actually fairly early.
Yes.
In the process.
And about a year after they had the facility up and running.
Mm-hmm. Was there. Mm-hmm. So you had just gotten your, what, Bachelor of Science degree in?
Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering.
In Mechanical Engineering. Talk a little bit, each of you, about, starting with you, Johnny, with what the process was like to become involved in such a secret mission, secret work.
Well, I'll always remember my first 2 weeks on the job, which was involved with reading the jet engine Bible from Pratt Whitney about how jet engines work, because coming out of college, you got a whole different, you know, theoretical specialty areas, but nothing very dramatic in depth of jet engines. So while my security clearance was being done on me in Texas, they were both paying me, and I was getting educated by reading a book. And the amazing part is, I got to Florida with my last dollar in the gas tank of my Chevy, and they paid me to read a book, and I felt like I was on vacation. So the shock initially was, you know, all these rows of engineers that, as far as the eye could see in the engineering building, reading a book for 2 weeks. And my dad calling me and said, "What kind of trouble are you into? All these guys from the Naval Bureau of Naval Weapons are checking you out in the neighborhood, how you grew up, what trouble you got into as a kid, and so forth." So yeah. I found that amusing.
Yeah. John?
I came out of the Air Force, and I was on a medium jet bomber that carried nuclear weapons. So I had a top secret clearance when I came out of the Air Force, which made it a little easier. And when I hired in, they basically put me over working on a gearbox off a previous engine that they were not going to use, which is a 304 engine. So I spent about 3 months working on 304 gearboxes and stuff like that until my clearance came through. And I grew up in Clawson, Michigan. I got calls from everybody up there saying, hey, the FBI is out there checking you out. What have you been doing?
This is even after you've been flying on the nuclear flights? There was.
Yeah, well, I was a ground crew member, but we had nuclear weapons out there. So,
I see.
The aircraft was basically, it was a nuclear bomber.
Wow.
And so anybody that got near it had to have a top secret clearance or better, or a Q clearance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I already had a clearance, so it was a little easier with me, but they still went all around where I grew up to find out what kind of guy I was.
Right. So you've been on a ground crew of a nuclear bomber.
Spent 4 years in the Air Force, B-47. Stratojet, serial number 512312. That was my bird for my entire enlistment. Those numbers 312.
Okay.
That's my email address, stratojet 312 at me.com.
Okay. That's good to know. So I'll stay with you for a moment, John. So what kinds of things? Well, let me back up a little bit. This morning, I talked to your colleagues about fuels and engine design and problems with, you know, the kinds of high temperatures that you were working at, things like this, the engineering aspects of it. So how does that translate for you? I guess this is a good question for both of you, but I'll start with you. For what you're practically doing on a day-to-day basis with this engine?
Well, primarily, the things ran extremely hot, and the issues came in teardown. We had to lubricate all of these threaded fasteners, all the nuts and bolts, with silver goop. We carried these little 1 ounce tubes of silver goop around, which was a high temperature anisees. And those things just seize up so bad. I took a 7/16 wrench and I bent it so it looked like a starter wrench trying to break those things loose.
Really?
And I had a big Nicholson nylon dead blow hammer about that big around that we'd get hydraulic rams in there. We'd have to beat on those things to get them apart in the early days. I mean, it was a real task getting one of those things apart once they'd run in the high altitude stands and run at high temperature. But it was an interesting job.
Well, so I'm going to ask you a really amateur's question. So the thing has run, and then you need to take it apart because adjustments need to be made to it, or?
No, we actually, what would happen is we'd run a test run, and then we'd disassemble it and inspect the hardware to decide whether the hardware is sufficient for what it's supposed to do or whether we had to redesign it. We had a third stage disc in there. We used to call it a flubber condition because the rim would expand. And when you sit on the table, it would bend like that. And if you took your hand, you push it down, and pop up the other way. And it was things like that. So we were dimensionally checking them to see if they expanded and to see how the pilots fit and if they stayed tight. And,
mm-hmm.
To see if there's any distress, any rubbing that wasn't supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had big fixtures where we'd take the runouts of all of the stators all bolted together and take the runouts of the compressors and grind them to get the clearances in. We were basically doing the impossible out there. You know, it's never been done before, anything even close to it. So it was a interesting environment to work in, and had all really first class people to work with, and very knowledgeable. So it was everybody used to call Pratt & Whitney, Florida, the finest training school in the eastern United States. And you left there, you could get a job anywhere you went. Oh, you worked at Pratt & Whitney?
Mm-hmm.
You're hired.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was an excellent place to work.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to stay with you for one more question, which was some of what I learned this morning also was about how different kinds of, well, the titanium itself, different alloys had to be developed in order to withstand the heat and the other kinds of things that had to happen in the plane. Would you be replacing pieces or rebuilding pieces, or how does that work?
We take
them
apart, inspect them, replace, rebuild, whatever it took, and sometimes they would just change the angle of incidence of the blades to prevent them from stalling when the engine was running, from stopping air pumping and mm-hmm. We worked for years with the compressor rigs, trying to get the best angle for the best performance on those things. And when we had a problem with a part that wasn't performing properly, we would they'd redesign it. We would manufacture it on site, put it in, change it, run it, take the test data that he worked on, and then bring it back and disassemble it and inspect it, clean it up, and stick it in another engine and run it again.
Okay, so now back to Johnny. Test data. So the engine's running. How is that data generated? How do you even know what's going on?
Well, that's you mentioned earlier the extreme temperatures, and temperature was the enemy of instrumentation. And to take data in the performance group, we specified locations of instrumentation from the front of the compressor all the way to the rear of the compressor, the burners, the turbine stage, and these are matched components that the thermodynamicist had matched these components to run at near their optimum conditions for takeoff, and then of course at the cruise altitude and speeds of over Mach 3. And so our performance group dealing with the temperature was making sense out of the data, which was usually, when I started recording of the data was mainly done with analog equipment, pressure and pressure gauges and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I came there, as I said earlier, in the first stages of the automation of gathering the data electronically by the computer, the IBM 1400 data acquisition system, which would snapshot the data, and we would look for accuracy that we could prove to the authorities that we were meeting the internal and external thrust and fuel consumption parameters of the engine. Mm-hmm. So we studied the engine in its through its components and worked with the data, with the instrumentation engineers to tell them which instruments were failing, and so they could redesign. Again, mm-hmm. all this stuff had to be done relatively quickly mm-hmm. as the test seemed to come in pretty rapid order. But mm-hmm. I can't remember, sawing off numerous temperature probes, both at the turbine and especially at the exit of the afterburner station, which would, at 3,500 degrees, would saw off a temperature probe, but real quick if it wasn't functioning. So that we had, you know, that wasn't our most reliable measuring station. But the data verification was of great importance, because not only had to convince the thermodynamicist that the engine was meeting its specifications or where it was relative to specification, but they had to in turn prove to the Air Force and CIA authorities that the performance was valid.
Mm-hmm. So when you're first there, that's pretty much in the early days of the engine, right? So do you see over time that you're slowly beginning to meet the parameters, or is it up and down, or how does that go?
As I understand the program, one of the questions that came up this morning was, when was the first engine run? And it turns out Christmas Eve of 1957, which was about almost 5 years before I got there. Mm-hmm. Obviously the early emphasis was on keeping the engine together and going through the things John had mentioned in terms of inspections and where potential failures were on the horizon. By time I got there, there had been some performance runs, but that was seemed to be secondary after you could stabilize the engine and keep it running for extended periods in a steady condition. Mm-hmm. Then they got more emphasis on the performance of it. And the early engines were a little, those were ones used in the Oxcart program, which were not as pushing the, well, they all were pushing the limits of temperature, but not until the SR-71 engine did it really get it up to its maximum potential, which was...
Oh, really?
So those early engines were detuned. I remember the first test engines at full afterburning thrust on takeoff was probably in the 28,000 to 30,000 pounds of takeoff thrust, whereas just a few years later, through the development of optimizing the components and pushing the temperature up in the thermodynamically, as you push up the temperature, you get more power out of the engine. And that later was developed into its maximum was of 34,000. So another 10 or so percent was added on to the performance. And the accuracy of the first test, the engines, as I explained, looked to me like a shotgun blast on a piece of graph paper. And I always marveled at my supervision that we could take a French curve. That was in the days of, you know, plots on graphs, and they could take a French curve and draw the data, the line through there, and said that fits the data. And that would take a lot of imagination to, but they knew the thermodynamic cycle, how theoretically it should look, so they had the sweet spot on the French curve to know how to, but by time, about 1964, we really had debugged the computerization of data gathering and trend line analysis. You could profile and you could pick out bad instrumentation. Mm-hmm. And by about 2 years hence, we really got nice trending data that was, everybody believed it, and we got paid, as I understand.
It worked,
it was working long before I ever gave it credit for working, because I didn't find out until in 1964 when Lyndon Johnson announced it that was actually a flying engine. I was a test stand. I was tied and shackled to the test stands to get the data off the test stands to verify the performance. So I had no idea it was, in a flying machine.
Let's just stop there for a second, because that's really interesting. So
that was a total mushroom.
A total mushroom, I don't get that.
You had a strict need to know, so outside of the parameters of your particular task, which mine was gathering the performance off the test stands and running it through our data reduction program to put it in engineering thermodynamic terms, I had no idea what the engine's role outside of that. To ask questions out of your need to know, we were constantly drilled on that because of our security.
Did you know it was an airline engine for an aircraft? Did you know that?
Well, I knew it was a jet engine. It was potentially going to be used, and I always thought potentially used in some aircraft. But
because this morning they were saying at first maybe it was a submarine, maybe it was, I mean, you weren't even supposed to know it was an aircraft. That's why I asked what sounds like a really dumb question, but.
Well, it was. I had a couple of college courses, so I had, fairly certain it was in some aircraft. And to know what we were simulating on the altitude test stand, when you're bringing in 700-800 degree Fahrenheit air, you know you're simulating some high Mach number over 3.
Yes.
So I knew it was in something that was flying. At least that it would go into something that was that fast, but I had no idea. That was totally closed and secured. Strict need to know.
So you find out when President Johnson reveals the program?
Yes, I did. Yes,
I did. And that's when you found out.
And I said, oh my goodness. So then our work took on much greater significance to us, because although the performance group was, again, its idea was to substantiate the data, the specifications that had been transmitted to the CIA and the Lockheed people, that it would indeed move a plane at that speed and that range, for that range. Our limits were, again, fairly narrow in just meeting the thermodynamic specifications.
Yeah. So there were a group of you who then had the aha moment when you found out about the plane.
Oh yeah. it was quite a shocker because if you see some failures on the test stand or hear of them, you appreciate the power and the risk of that engine. That thing is just, it was just enormous to go to a test stand, the block when the engine was running at sea level. It was buffeting the air at about so hard that your lungs and your heart would actually hurt.
Really?
Of course, you had ear protection, but you didn't waste any time of hot footing it between your parked car and your in the blockhouse, which was insulated, of course.
How tall was it?
How tall was the?
I see that picture there that's behind your.
It looked to me like it was probably about like the ceiling. Or maybe a little less.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was fairly on the, and that was at sea level, on the sea level simulation test stand. And the altitude, that was all in big, I can't remember how many feet diameter, I would say maybe 10-foot diameter ductwork. And the air was heated upstream of that ductwork to the pressure and temperature conditions. And so you saw this thing in kind of a fold-down suitcase arrangement there when you button it up ready for the to start the testing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but on sea level, John, does that about seem about right?
It was about probably 16 to 20 feet somewhere mm-hmm. in that area for the total height.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically, it had a block wall on one side and a block house on the other, and you could visually see it from the control room, but
mm-hmm.
It was fairly tall. The engine stand itself was probably 8 feet tall
mm-hmm.
that it was mounted into, and it was on a thrust bed. It was a couple of feet off the ground.
Jeez.
Seems like excuse me.
Yeah, Johnny mentioned that when President Johnson announced that aircraft,
mm-hmm.
the next morning we were all pulled into a meeting at the plant, and we were told that project was top secret, and we were not to discuss it with anyone, period. So he spilled the beans right after President Kennedy passed away, and he didn't know about it until President Kennedy passed away and became president.
Right, but nonetheless, you were told?
We were told it was still top secret, do not talk about it. That was a plus or minus one employee instruction.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about it, they found out you were gone. Couldn't talk to your spouses or anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But was it the same for you, that was when you realized what you'd been working on?
Well, I knew it was an aircraft engine, and,
sure.
Because it basically it pumped air. It was a big air pump.
Mm-hmm.
The compressor sucked the air in and threw it in a combustion system. They add fuel to it,
mm-hmm.
went to the turbines, which drove the compressor and into the afterburner and out supersonic exhaust. Just a shriek. It was ungodly noisy.
Mm-hmm.
The vibrations, all your organs were vibrating. Not only that, the macadam you were standing on was vibrating hard enough to tickle your feet and your shoes. You walk on the outside edge of your feet, and those muffs, they'd be bouncing on your head.
Oh my God.
It was noisy, unbelievable.
This thing that struck me walking to, hot footing it to the blockhouse, he called it. I always looked at, thought, and I had seen or heard about incidences where the engine blew, and when I was You had a porthole that you could look through to see the physical engine running there, and I always noticed that the it was not in the plane of the turbine or compressor parts, because when those if an engine cut loose, a turbine disc could just cut through just about anything as it comes spinning out of there about 7,000 RPM. So you did not want to be in the way. I've heard of the incidences where one flew apart and dug across the parking lot. I don't think it took out any cars, but it went probably quite a ways as it took off out of the engine. I'm not sure how much of that was caught on film, but it was it made me think about walking in the plane of the engine of the turbine or compressor.
Sure. Did you have any experience of any things like that, of accidents? Or
I was not out there when they came apart, but a disc could come out of one of the engine. Of course, there's 213 external tubes on there carrying fuel and oil. Mm-hmm. And when the disc cuts through that stuff, it's a big fireball, and a disc came out, hit the macadam, jumped the blockhouse over to the other side, made a turn, and took off out towards the parking lot. It was when those things come apart, they're impressive. If you look at old aircraft photos, you'll see a red line around the engine, mm-hmm. and that's where the turbine is. Those things are, they're just hot almost to the melting point. Mm-hmm. And then the shark mouth down at the inlet, say, don't walk near the inlet, it'll eat you. Mm-hmm. Don't get near that turbine plane.
Sure.
Just minimize your time near it. Just walk past it, don't stop and talk where you're sitting in front of that turbine plane, because should it come apart, it'll ruin your whole day.
Your whole life.
Pretty much.
God, I was gonna ask you, oh, I know, I mean, I guess, again, from a layperson's point of view, you're working on this thing that's top secret, you don't know what the application is, but you know that it's an engine for an aircraft. So do you ever sort of speculate, or are you just so focused on what you're doing that you don't think about those things? Do you wonder what kind of aircraft this might be that it would be used in?
Well, I had myself, I had come out of the ROTC program where we were yet pretty channeled and disciplined,
yes.
thinking. And so once they gave the marching orders of need to know and don't talk about it, I was so busy with my job. And on weekends and so forth, we just tried to unwind a little bit because it was very intense to get the information as quickly turned around as you could. So I didn't even think about talking about it, and I knew enough about the, I loved the job, so I didn't want to jeopardize in any way asking dumb questions about where it's going to be used. So it's one of those things that...
Yeah, I wasn't asking so much whether you asked, but I also do know that that's true in a lot of highly technical or scientific pursuits, that you can get really, really focused just on the task
at hand.
Yeah,
and
very you're not
focused.
Thinking about.
Yeah, you're focused on accurate and quick turnaround on data as we could. That was my focus.
Yeah.
You probably had different.
It wasn't that different. With me, of course, I was working with the hardware more than the number crunching, that sort of stuff. So it was basically looking at the hardware and making sure when you get a new part that you don't see any flaws in it, mm-hmm. when you assemble it, and just doing the best job you could, because eventually somebody's life was going to depend on what you did. And so it, with me, I just, it was something that we just worked at, and Pratt & Whitney was a place where when they hired you, they expected you to know your job, they expected you to do it, so you didn't have somebody standing over you all the time. It was, so you learned to do the job, you did it well, because other people depended on you, and it was a very pleasant working environment in that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't micromanaged, so to speak. You were expected to expand your skills, and you were compartmentalized. You were expected to work your area, don't talk to other people about the areas they work.
Right, right. Now, there's things written about the fact that it took longer than expected, and again, this isn't my area of expertise, but I don't think I'm wrong in saying longer than expected for that engine to reach where it needed to be used in the A-12. Is that right?
Well, proposals are always optimistic. You give them the shortest period of time that you think that you can design and develop and manufacture this thing and get it out there.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, in the real world, things happen. And when things happen, the programs stretch out. And every program I've ever worked on, I was in aviation 47 years, every single one of them stretched out.
So, were you conscious, that there were certain deadlines? I agree with you that that's always true. There are a lot of, especially during the contracting period, people get very optimistic estimates of when things can get done.
But were you under
any kind of sense of deadline, or was it more get this thing right, kind of?
Basically, it was the 12-hour shifts and the Saturdays and the Sunday work. When they start paying you overtime and double time and wanting you to work long shifts and wanting you to work weekends, and every once in a while they come on and say, you know, we need to do this, we need to turn it, get it done, and the size of the crews that they worked overtime, you knew that there was schedule issues you had to push because they basically, you had bigger crews working longer hours.
Right.
I think from my perspective, as a engineer, I wasn't aware of the target dates, but as John said, it became obvious as they started running multiple shifts on tests, and turnaround times got quicker, you know, faster, and you know, there was more pressure to get the data turned around and verified. Then it became aware of you know, certain targets, and the performance target on the SR-71 seemed the engine, that 34K engine, seemed to be the one that really hit me square, because that was as it was explained to me, that was a payday to verify the crew's performance at the thrust and at the altitude. And I wasn't aware of the specification or the operational aspects. I was peripherally aware that there were 50-hour endurance tests that would be running parallel to the performance test. That was a whole different emphasis on, that was 50 hours of continuous operation.
Right.
And those were lightly instrumented engines, except for the vibration pickups, which would be a precursor to failure. And so they were instrumented different, they weren't instrumented for the performance and the thermodynamic properties like the performance group was responsible for. They were more endurance, they call them endurance tests. And, so I think the endurance test came before the performance, because they could put a underperforming engine into a plane and it would get to a certain Mach number and altitude, I suppose, if it was flying. I can surmise what they were doing and how they were going about it, but it had to hold together and be pretty doggone reliable before you got to the numbers part of it.
Right, right. So one of the things that really amazes me as I look back at it, and you've talked about it a little bit, Johnny, is the beginning of the computerization of things, but that from the reading I've done and just talking to people today, how much of this was done without the kind of computer capability that we have today, which just sort of amazes me for the kind of feedback need.
That's a loaded question.
Okay. Why is that loaded?
To think back 50 years until the IBM era, and I guess I had to recall from the first computers in I think it was in the 40s or 50s. When I got to Pratt Whitney, it had the main computer that was in 62 was the IBM 709, and then the 7090, 7094 came shortly thereafter, bigger, faster. There is absolutely, those are a head of a pin compared to the power of the big computers today. It was,
right. But
compared to a slide rule and a Friedman calculator,
right.
One of the impressive things in the performance group was the banks and the rows, every desk had a performance desk had a Friedman calculator, and it was the grinding, and compared to that, which I understand the engine was mainly designed with off of slide rules and calculators, that was really, I don't know what kind of computers they had when they were designing in the late 50s, but the 709 was, the 790 was a large computer, and it saved countless hours of Friedman work or slide rule work.
Yes.
Because it could, it would crunch through the numbers pretty quick.
Right. And I don't know how much that kind of the technological changes that came with the computer would affect the kinds of things that you were doing, but certainly I wonder what you would you think about if that plane had to, that engine had to be built today, what kinds of, and I'm trying to get some sort of comparative retrospective look on the world the way it was when you were there, that 10 years that you were there, and say the world that came later as far as the kind of work you did. I don't know if that's a, does that question make sense to you?
Is this watch I've got on right now?
Yeah.
Has more capability than the computers had back then.
Yeah.
The computers were just in their infancy. It took them forever to crunch numbers. And so when, and like Johnny said, they used French curves, they used slide rules to, for calculating. They used drafting machines, which is a just a big machine on a table, and they used Mylar pencils,
yes,
on vellums. The whole thing was designed that way. They said, well, let's see, the stress is going to go like this, so let's shape it like this. I mean, it was sort of perspective. I think that looks good. We didn't, and this worked before, but it's like Kelly Johnson said, you know, he said, we had to invent everything. That means all of the fuels, all of the oils, all of the plumbing. We couldn't even use standard plumbing. It took us years just to develop the tubes on the engine. It was that far advanced, and they've destroyed all the tooling stuff, and I'm not sure we could build those engines in the aircraft today with the CAD-AM, because you've lost a lot of experience with the people that work there, and people have never worked in that kind of environment. So the CAD-AMs they got, they can make beautiful parts, you know, and computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacturing. And with the holography that they use now, they can tune out any stress areas and everything. So, but that was an impossible task that a lot of dedicated people managed to accomplish, and nobody else in the world has accomplished it.
It's like it was a handcrafted airplane in a sense.
Yeah, I've heard the pilots say that every aircraft has its own personality. They all fly a little bit different, every single one of them. But yeah, it was, they were pretty much all hand-built.
Yeah.
Goes for the engines, too.
Yeah. Now, talk a little bit. You said something about the plumbing. So what did you mean when you say the tubing had to be invented? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, when we started out with the plumbing, the standard practice was to use stainless steel tubes, and they have these little ferrules that they put on the ends for the threaded connectors.
Yes.
And they would braze them on. But the engine runs so hot that we had to use a gold nickel alloy that melted at over 1800 degrees. Well, by the time you get the tube to about 2100 degrees, it comes apart. And every time you remelted that braze, it went up another 50 degrees, the melt point, so you could destroy the tube. When you did that, the ferrule, which was a conical ferrule set on a conical seat, it destroyed the heat treat. So when you torqued the nut, the ferrule would spread out and go into the nut and jam it. So you use the tube two or three times, and that was done for. And then what they did was they came out with a process where they made, they call it integral ferrules, and they would take the tube and they would melt a big blob on the end and machine the ferrule into the parent material. So it was very good. And they, with the heat rejection, they wrapped it with asbestos and they put this corrugated stainless on it, seam welded it, and it was like sticking your hand in a bucket of razor blades to work on them.
Really?
Yeah, because they had these two sharp edges going down there, this real thin stainless steel with the seam weld. I mean, it was like a razor blade factory. And you used up band-aids like crazy working on it.
Really?
And later on, they started polishing the tubes, and they sprayed on this paint that looked blood red, and they'd heat it in the oven, and it would turn gold.
Hmm.
And you ended up with 208 gold-plated tubes and gearboxes and oil tanks. It was the dress-up kit, man. It looked like it came out of Hollywood. But and then later on, they had to go back to some of the corrugated tubing to keep the oil from cooling down too much in a descent where they pull the power back. So it was, even years after those airplanes were flying, they were still being developed and improved. It was, mm-hmm. It was very interesting, and you had engineers scratching their head trying to figure out how to make that better, and it was very interesting. At one time, we were handling all those gold-plated tubes with cotton gloves, so you didn't take it off because it was 0.2 of a mil or 0.0002 thousandths of an inch thick. It was just basically a color coat, and they sprayed Mylar like a plastic coating over to make them last better at time. But it was just a never-ending process. The engine runs so hot that it's like 1,300-1,400 degrees on an afterburner, and you got these lines with fuels and oils in them way past their flash point to auto ignite. Mm-hmm. So you can't let the fluid stop in here. You'd have little non-plugging restrictors so they would flow all the time, even when the actuators weren't moving, the fluid would flow. And they would reject the hot fuel back into the fuel tank and replenish it with cold fuel going into the fuel pump. And that was a hydraulic system, used fuel with a Teflon additive so it had some lubricity. And we even tried to use fuel for the oil for the lubrication at one time, but we weren't able to get it done. We were running rigs with it. The engine, we talk about the engine, we talk about cold section and hot section. And basically the cold section is the compressor where they pull all of the cold air in, and then it goes into the combustor, they add fuel to heat and expand it. It goes into the turbines, into nozzles that accelerates it to drive the compressors and the accessories. Then it goes out into the afterburner and they throw more fuel into it and drive it out the back at supersonic speeds to create the thrust. And that, what we call the cold section, they use primarily Waspaloy, which was a Pratt & Whitney turbine material in the compressor. It ran so hot, we were actually using turbine materials in the compressor. And Super Waspaloy and a lot of other Inconel and Hastex and a lot of very sophisticated metals in the turbine and the afterburner section. And we had to ceramic coat a lot of the parts because the temperature was so hot it would melt the part. So we ceramic coated them as a thermal barrier to keep the temperature from getting to the metal, and we had cooling air that came in and formed a boundary layer to keep the hot gases away from the ceramic barrier. It was a very interesting time.
That was just really interesting what you just said. Wow.
We basically did what, like, most of the people in the industry didn't think it could be done.
Yeah.
We had a altitude test facility where they could choke the inlet, they could heat every molecule of air that was going into the inlet to 950 degrees Fahrenheit. We had big exhausters of steam ejectors that could, at sea level, you have 29.92 inches of mercury pressure. We could pull it down to like 0.2 inches of mercury out the exhaust when it was running at max power. It had big boilers out of a destroyer, I think. It was just amazing what we had out those facilities and what they were doing in an area where they were using slide rules and Mylar pencils and
right.
stuff. And it amazes me today to think of what was accomplished out there.
Yeah. Thank you.
I was going to take a swag at one other thing you brought up earlier about the computerization. The engine could be modeled. When I got there, there was a model on the big 7090 computer that would simulate mathematically. You could put in flight conditions, and it would engine power settings, and it would come up with the internal thermodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So it was mathematically modeled in the computer. The model would easily fit on a PC today, and you know, just bang, bang, bang. We have to wait, you know, hours for computer runs because of the queuing of the big 7090 computer. I'm sure today, if engineers have a knack for always maxing out the computer, however big it is,
yes.
And even the large computers of today, I think they'd come up with they probably have much more sophisticated thermodynamic models. And the interesting thing, when I was always amazed, who had the thermodynamic background to write these models. And there were a few very highly educated engineers with master's and doctorate degrees, like Dr. Abernathy and our boss of the whole performance group, Norm Cotter, who put together those mathematical models that the rest of us could use. So it was marvelous how they could had the smarts to put together that, and yes. So you could simulate off design conditions. We could verify certain data points on the flight from takeoff or cruise altitude, but all that other stuff was just done with mathematical models and reasonably accurately. So,
well, gentlemen, we're real close to closing time. I mean, there was just so much more we could talk about, but I appreciate you taking this time. If there's anything in the last couple of minutes we have left that you'd like to add, we'll just consider this a prelude to but not really. I think that people that are interested in this subject matter would be real interested in hearing what you both had to say, even though we have just had about an hour to do it in. So is there anything you want to add?
For me, it was a thrilling time to work on something like that, technology was being developed on a daily basis, and so many different aspects with so many moving parts and breaking down barriers and any plumbing fitting or any part on the engine that could fail probably at one time did, and it was very crunch time. Seemed like the whole 3 years was a blur. We had some slack after we proved the specification level, the performance level, but up until that time, it was head down and arms moving.
Yeah.
It was, again, as I said earlier, very intense and rewarding for us guys to be working on something like that.
Yeah. So
my best job ever.
Yeah, well, really an incredible job.
Okay. Johnny mentioned Dr. Abernathy.
Yes.
And one of the things he did was he invented the process of bleeding air out of the compressor, which is relatively cool air for the turbine section. But he bled like 20% of the air out of the compressor at high altitude and ran it back into the hot section turbines and the afterburners to help cool it. It cooled the exhaust on, allowed them to add fuel, made the engine less surge prone at altitude. And that was the first engine ever developed with that bypass type of system. And also the afterburner, if you look at it, is about 1.5 diameters long. It's 1.5 times longer than this big a diameter.
Yes.
Up to that time, the minimum length of an afterburner was considered to be 2.5 diameters. So it shortened that engine up a good 4 or 5 feet.
Wow.
And of course, it reduced the weight as well. And you have to take weight to altitude, it takes more fuel
right.
and more thrust. So it there was so many firsts on that program that just can't think of them all.
Right.
Thermodynamically, that was a huge breakthrough.
Yeah. So it, it just in the materials, developing the different materials,
right.
Even the thermal barrier coatings, the ceramics, the earlier ones that chip and break and fall off because ceramics are brittle and the metal parts are expanding and contracting.
Right.
So it was just a task trying to get a thermal barrier coating that it would work.
Right.
So it was down in the test cells in the early days, we'd blow parts out of the back end of that thing. We had a flat bottom aluminum rowboat. We'd go out in the lake behind it, take a row out in amongst the alligators, hook a rope to the parts and bring them back and haul them into engineering and look at them to see where they failed and see how to redesign it. It was a very, very interesting time.
Yeah.
And I know I was certainly happy to be part of it.
Well, I think on the retrieving parts from the alligator's jaws piece, we will end it. And I thank you very much. To be continued.
Okay.